Escape of Cthulhu presents a Cthulhu Invictus scenario, A Balance of Blood by Matt Puccio. There you go. It's all on you, Matt. Go.
And chide us, too.
Take it away, Matt.
Silliness.
I think you should just ask all questions.
Well, we had also discussed, and I am sort of curious a little bit, we'd also discussed the whole hierarchy thing, which is a separate topic. But
master, slave, officer, soldier.
Right, exactly.
Just the general Invictus discussion.
Well, it could be writing and playing any scenario where one PC is subservient to another in some way.
Sounds like that may be the way to kick off the thing Sean was talking about with the PvP.
Yeah. Well, why don't we start with...
Before you start, Jim, are you recording this or not?
Yes, I have it.
God, I hope not.
Oh.
Perfect.
No, that's fine. All right, so to start with, I've run this once before for my local in-person group, and it took two sessions of about 5 to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. So you guys didn't really take that much more time. They did something quite a bit different than what you did. I mean, it ended up the same, but...
we took 16.
Ooh, what, right? What did they do?
16, did you do... Was it seven sessions or eight?
Eight.
Okay.
And I feel like that last session would have been longer if you hadn't helped us along a little bit.
It's true. It would have been longer, yeah. Yeah, and this is the problem with combat in Call of Cthulhu. You either make it really fast and everybody dies, or, to be honest, it kind of drags. So anyway, we can come to that later. And you can give me your thoughts about it. And so you understand my intention here. I am planning on, in some fashion, publishing this on the repository, the Miskatonic repository. But I'm also happy to, like, completely rework it. So based on feedback, and obviously I was taking notes as we played and have some thoughts of my own, but... I guess maybe after we answer questions, you can give me your thoughts. And
was your entire meaning and, you know, I guess drive behind the scenario to create so much disinformation that your players are tearing their hair out by halfway through?
wow, that's a deleted question. Yeah.
So. I think because all right. Good. So my intention,
I will say, I did like the fact that it was a lot of investigation and different leads where didn't really know who was bad and thought different people were bad at different times, but it was also frustrating.
Well, okay. So part of my intention was to create a moral quandary that had several different horns, more than two horns to it. So there's this, you guys are working for Imperial Rome, and so you have your duty. You are faced with this guy who is obviously doing something evil, the Prytanios, the sorcerer. He's sacrificing people for some dark magic. But he's doing that in service to his master, his lord, whatever. And you guys are sort of meant to, at least from the Imperial side, support that guy, right? You want to find out what's going on and not disrupt. If he's in control, the idea is there are all these political factions trying to take power away. And if he disappears, if Vahavunis dies, then there's this power vacuum and the Parthian kings might come in, the Alans might come in, and it's just going to cause havoc for Rome. So if you support him, then at least you have someone that maybe you can control, that Rome can control in here. Now, I don't know whether or not that actually came across that way.
I really enjoyed, as a player, getting to bend my normal moral outlook with exactly that in mind. Sort of this guy, well, I guess there were two parts of that. One, this guy's obviously a jerk, but he's our jerk, and
right.
he's only slightly a jerk by contemporaneous standards.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think you could push that a lot harder if he was a worse dude. So he did some bad things, but not some really mm-hmm. terrible things.
I think a lot of it is how you view history. I think this is my first Invictus setting, but all the bad stuff, like the when we talk to the guys in the stocks, they're talking about how he's, you know, going out and kind of, having his way with whatever villager woman that he wants, and he's, you know, putting people to death because they're stealing bread. I mean, to me, that's like at this point, this is again, that's like our iron-fisted. It to me, it sounds like.
Historically accurate.
Yes, exactly. So it's like I'm not sure that I feel like my character would have been from a gentler background and been kind of shocked, you know what I mean, or repulsed by that.
Yeah, no, I totally get it.
Yeah, yeah.
So what kind of things could he do that would say, oh, he's really a bad guy? I have this internal turmoil.
Yeah, but I think he's got to do it either in front of us. He's got to do it either in front of us. Yeah. Either in front of us or to some of the player characters.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I guess because for me, I think he would have to be potentially undermining the authority of Rome.
Yeah,
that would be the real thing that would have gotten me against. If I had thought I can't support him because he's gonna say kill the legate, or he's gonna backstab us. He's gonna so if I thought he was not a man of his word. So I feel like that. Might have been a more, for me anyway, would have been a more potent.
I was afraid that if I did something like that, he's not going to support Rome, so we'll just let him die.
Right.
And that would be too obvious. Like, I wanted you to have to make that choice. Mm-hmm. So the very first opening scene when his men trample the woman in the town, mm-hmm. that was trying to set the stage, but mm-hmm. you're saying like have him actually do something.
I think if you do that, you make us choose. Like, do we at that point? It's like it's not just knowledge that he's doing this stuff. It's like this is going down right now, and it's like if we have any moral quandary, you know, we're complicit if we don't step in. Mm. Does that make sense?
Well. But at that point, I think it's too early in the plot. We haven't been posed the question of who is Vahavunis yet.
Right, right.
So yeah, I thought that was an effective scene.
The information doesn't matter
yeah,
to us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I thought that was an effective opening. I think all of us thought he was a bad person.
Yeah.
And I think it was only that, at least for me, it was only that I was sort of playing with the idea that is sort of the norm. Like, he's a bad person by today's standards.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that. I mean, I thought that was a really fun part of this adventure, was that we were all kind of potentially not, I mean, we weren't murder hobos necessarily, but we were definitely, like, it was a different world.
I gotta say, it surprised the heck out of me when you told us to release the people from the stocks. I was like, what?
You know, it surprised Mercy? Me a little bit too, and even though I did it. And I guess I was thinking that that he was going actually, and maybe this would work. That his violence was so over the edge that I thought the village was going to revolt, and that would not be a good thing for me and Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about that from a sort of, and I sort of thought, you know what, we've got this guy over a barrel, Vahavunis. Like, he owes us big.
Mm-hmm.
This is the right time to start setting the seeds for to make the populace welcome the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. I like that.
You guys did bring up multiple times whether there were maybe agents in the city or whether the city was going to sort of support some of this. Maybe there's something there as far as the story. Like maybe if the players do go and try to rile up some of the locals or win their support or something. Ooh, I don't know.
What would be awesome is if the locals show up trying to stop the moon ritual. Because they don't like Vahavunis. Maybe they try and, have an uprising while we're there trying to help basically everybody.
They think that
we're there to help Vahavunis.
I think the idea of the quandary, what you've got to have is it Vahavunis or somebody else will be exactly like it? Like, I have no idea who was behind the Albasti and some of the stuff right there. That's one of the questions. But if it was like someone in his family, that's someone that potentially Rome could leverage. It's like, do we stick with the guy that's here or do we support someone who's trying to overthrow him? Will that be better for Rome kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess you could always make the decision to let him die, but then, save his son so that his son can be.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah, groomed. You can set that up
properly. Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
But what about if there was some kind of more obvious interaction with a threat to Rome, like have some Parthians show up, or maybe even on the road before you get to town, you encounter some of the Alans.
Why don't you just tell us at this point? Because the
plot.
The plot. I like the idea of there being a looming threat. I never heard from the sublegate, nor were we in that way that doesn't make any sense in the real world, where we all briefed on sort of why this is important. And the coins in the very beginning where Rome sort of made fun of the guy. Mm-hmm. Gave me mixed emotions about how important he was.
Mm-hmm.
I think without that scene, if we all knew going in and the sublegate, knew to tell us, hey, this guy's a jerk, but he's our jerk. And if he's not there, he's a nice buffer between us and people we don't really want to fight. Mm-hmm. As long as he's on our team. And this is standard Roman thing. Oh, we'll put this guy up here. We'll make him the leader. And when the bad guys attack, he'll get wiped out, but Rome will have a little time to react.
Yeah, and I guess maybe part of that is my fault in not briefing you fully, or I don't know, I guess in character you weren't briefed, but out of character, I can't remember if I gave you in the notes document, I kind of did an info dump of all of that, but except for the coins.
Right.
So maybe I just need to make sure to say, hey, all of the players need to know in character about these coins. And the coins, by the way, weren't so much to make fun of him. They were actually a threat to him.
Right.
Because with the coins.
He took it the way I remember it, he took it a different way. I mean, I guess I would just say that I think that maybe what you say to him going in is like, well, he's our guy, or at least he's the best guy. And if it's not him, you got to figure out who's going to be the guy by the time the legate gets there.
So do you think it would be worth having sort of a very brief scene where the legate briefs the sublegate in the presence of all the other PCs and says, this is what I need you to go and do. And it would just be very brief, but it would be enough to say, hey, this is your mission. This is why you're all going here. I'm going to follow you 10 days behind because I've got some other business.
Yeah, I think something like that would set the tone for us to know. Because what I really liked about this scenario was, one, it was investigative. But even up until the very end, which is I think where Steve's going, I still wasn't entirely sure who was responsible.
Yep.
I really like that as a guy who figures out movies on TV shows halfway through the show and has to spend the rest of the time going, okay, let's get to the big ending. Like, I really like that. And there was also a political intrigue going on that I think got sort of short shifted because we didn't really know, we didn't have that other layer. I didn't feel briefed enough in that other layer of interaction that could have been going on.
And I think it would have, I had sort of made up in my head a little thing about the legate, but I think, yeah, having that scene and knowing maybe that it's either, you know, that he's very temperamental or, you know, that there's some reason to be scared of his arrival. Like, it's not just that we have a job to do, but that I think that could be a pretty powerful motivator.
Sure. Okay.
Right. And we don't have to be in the room. We can be in the next room, but the legate has a loud voice.
Yeah,
sure.
Thus creating that sense of threat, like, this had better be perfect by the time I get there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got a timeline for when this ceremony happens, I think his arrival is the day after the ceremony.
Yeah.
Because it felt like, it's like, okay, we did this. Now we got five days to clean up.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like,
yeah,
it's
that's
like
good.
Your parents are showing up on Wednesday, not Sunday afternoon after the party you had on
Saturday. If you trash the place, you need to.
Exactly. Yeah. I got a lot of time to clean it up.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I definitely felt a little relief that I think would be better without in knowing that we had a few days extra.
No, that's awesome. Yep. Good suggestions. So let me just tell you the overall plot. And,
Wait, could Steve come back? Because he just said be right back, and I think he'll be very sad if he doesn't.
I think when he comes back.
Wait, I'm back now.
Oh, he's
what? Wait, what?
And that's why.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Oh, my God. Brilliant.
No, I don't want to hear it again. That one was enough, really. Yeah, okay.
Well, good talking to you all. Night.
Yeah.
Good night.
Oh, man.
So, all right. So the Albasti is an actual Armenian folklore, a creature, a demon, a spirit. And she is a spirit of vengeance. What was that? She is a spirit of vengeance. She is a creature of vengeance and revenge and justice. And she often can take control of pregnant women. And again, this is all sort of background to real folklore. thank you. So that was sort of the genesis of this. And so I thought, well, why is she coming here? She's coming to take vengeance on evil men. But I didn't want it to be obvious who the evil man was, and so I created two. One is Pritanios and one is Vahavunus. And she basically inhabited the body of Phaedimia a year ago, or 13 months ago, actually, during a full moon. And the concept is that the Albasti's power increases as the full moon gets closer and then wanes, and the personality of the person that she is inhabiting comes to the fore as her power wanes. So each month the Albasti becomes more powerful and does something to basically get back at Vahavunus, or get revenge but get revenge on him.
So it's a possession.
Yes. Mm. And then, so she was drawn to this area because of Vahavunus and his mistreatment of people. But she discovers, hey, there's this other guy who's just as bad, Pritanios. He's doing awful things. So let me pit them against each other. And because the Romans are showing up, let me also get the Romans involved in this and use them as a tool. Her goal is to cause as much suffering as possible for both Pritanios and Vahavunus. So she kills Vahavunus's mother. She causes the miscarriage of Phaedimia. She causes the moon sickness of Ataridates. She's doing all these things. She's causing the crops in the local area to go bad. She's causing all these things for the suffering, basically, to cause Vahavunis to suffer further. When the Romans arrive, she says, oh, here's an opportunity for me to pit Prytanios against Vahavunis, or vice versa, or at least to cast suspicion on the Greek and cause her husband to maybe fight him or kill him or torture him or something. Let's see, where else? Other pieces of the curse tablets. So she is responsible for the curse tablets. And I think you guys were trying to chase down who made these tablets and who spoke Greek. And so there was a lot of back and forth on that. And I think I felt a little bit trapped, like, okay, how can I explain this?
Handwriting analysis,
Well, yeah, I put these here. How can I explain this, that she wrote these? So the Albasti is an avatar or a form of Nyarlathotep. As the Red Queen or the Lady in Red, there is one of his many thousand names, is the Queen in Red. And so my thought process was that, she's trying to cause suffering. She's doing all these things. She has extremely powerful magical capability to twist people's minds. She's got a bunch of different mind-affecting spells that she can use if necessary. She does some of that final encounter.
So does she do this stuff in Phaedimia's body, or does she do this stuff?
Yep.
On her. I mean, does Phaedimia's body sort of get claws and she moves around, or is just Phaedimia out when?
Yep. So exactly what happened in the last scene. She leaves the body, which is what she did at night before she stole the horses. So to tie all of that in, Phaedimia goes to sleep. The moon rises. Albasti comes out of her body, goes into her form, her night hag form, steals the horses, which is, again, another part of the actual folklore, that she would make horses lathered and basically steal horses. So tying that into the actual Armenian folklore of these Vishops, which are the dragon men, there actually is a god named I don't have it up right now, but anyway, he's Vahan the Dragon Reaper in ancient Armenian. And those dragon stones, the Vishapakar, are actual stones in Armenia that people believe were once dragons. And this guy was the dragon slayer. So anyway, she uses that again to sort of, in the culminating scene, her thought is, okay, these Romans are interfering. They're causing a lot of problems. I need to put my plan in motion. And her goal is to capture Vahavunis and carry him off and hand him over to the Alans. And the Alans can torture him and do whatever he wants to. And that will complete her vengeance or her revenge. Mm. So it's pretty convoluted, and you don't necessarily see all of that. She asks the Romans to investigate Prytanios to hopefully pit her husband against Prytanios.
So she is controlling Phaedimia enough to do that when Phaedimia is awake.
Because you are so close to the full moon.
Right. Yep.
She has almost total control over Phaedimia at this point of the month.
Yep.
And so when you're talking to her and you're doing insight rolls, she's got a really high POW. And I was doing opposed rolls when you actually said insight. I was doing opposed rolls. I wasn't telling you the exact results, but I was actually doing those rolls. It's just that she has such a high POW. And then my backup for that is, if, let's say, you decide that, you know, she is actually not telling the truth, she does have like a mind erase spell, and there's a couple other spells that I gave her that as long as she's one-on-one with you, and this is what I was thinking was going to happen with Steve's character when he was talking to her by himself, I was thinking, all right, he's going to start probing and she's going to have to do some kind of mind control on him. Right. But it never got there. It could have been interesting.
I spent all my time playing with the dolls.
Yep.
It seems like it would be nice to see or hear about, and maybe we did and we just missed it, Faedimia change, so that either Vahavunis thinks something is up or she's acting odd. Or like, I feel like it seems odd that a spirit could both take over so completely and have such a good command of her personality.
There was one definite clue that I gave you, but you guys kind of explained it away as maybe depression at having lost her child.
Okay, yeah.
The boy, and I think maybe this is when Steve or Max, maybe it was Max talking to the boy, and he said something about, Mommy got really sad and she was upset all the time or something like that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I kind of remember that, but that sounded too realistic. Yep, I was like, yeah, okay.
Exactly. So that's I guess what I don't want to do is tip the hand to her too soon. Like I want to at least give you a chance to get there, and you can certainly get there. One of the things that got a little bit disrupted because you pursued Prytania so hard, and there was the whole scene with Sean hitting himself with the book, and which was awesome. There was that pestle with the powder in it that he tried to use in the first time Atarides had the moon sickness. Mm-hmm. And if you had taken that powder, because there was some of it left in the pestle, and thrown it on her, you would have seen the albasti. Mm. And if you had done that in front of Vahavunis, then he would have been like, oh my God, something's wrong with my wife, and he would have believed you. It's pretty, you know, I don't know the chances of a player doing that. The first playtest didn't do that either.
Slim to none.
Yeah, you'd have to like catch her alone. Because
there's nothing pointing towards it being like a possessor creature.
Well, you know, one of the ways I think we flubbed what seems so obvious at this point is a lot of this stuff is happening at night, but it's like we're out doing other stuff or just doing all our investigation during the day. You know, we're either off at the caves, or I think one night we were down in the town or whatever. But it's like if we just hung around, there would have been chances for us to kind of encounter the thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what the players do, right? Like if the players say we're going to set a watch and we're going to patrol around the building, then you probably would get a glimpse of the albasti leaving. But at that point, you really have no reason to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seemed like, I mean, there's only a couple nights in there from when when there seemed like there was a night issue, and then boom.
Mm-hmm. So pursuing the dragon men into the hills, that did not happen in my other group. They did explore the glade initially. They find the woolen doll. That was the other clue that you might suspect her, right? That she's always dressed in red. I kept describing her in red dress and red clothes. And there's this red scarf tied around it. And then B, she gives the son the doll, and you find a doll that looks just like it. And I mean, I think you guys twig to this pretty quickly. He's got blonde hair, which is unusual, and the doll had blonde hair. It's just that I don't know what your thought process was around that, because you didn't seem to really do anything with that.
I mean, I was sure the albasti had taken the doll from the kid and taken it up to the dragon things. Right. But I didn't know what to do with that information, if anything.
Mm-hmm. You know what would be an interesting twist is if Faedimia remembers making some but not all of the dolls.
Mm.
So if you asked her, is this yours?
Well, who made this doll of Andragoras and tied the scarf around it? Maybe, you know, the scarf thing. That was a Albasti.
Oh, so there, yeah, maybe not even just the dolls, if there's like little gaps in her memory here and there where, you know, Artaradates is reminding her, no, mommy, remember you did that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good possession symptom.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I guess I was pretty well thinking that Phaedimia, I mean, just by process of elimination, but I couldn't get anything on her at all, mm-hmm. like, in my mind. I mean, everybody else I'd eliminated.
Like, yeah.
She's the only one left, and she's the, from a sort of detective novel, she's the perfect murderer, so to speak, because, you know, no one would suspect her, and she's been a victim, and, you know, all of that. But I just could not, I couldn't find anything to latch onto with her.
Here's one thing I would say that might solidify it, and maybe it's too much, like you're saying, is that right now Phaedimia just seems to be chosen kind of at random, and also the kind of evilness of Vahavunis and Britannia's are both just kind of widespread. Like if there's a specific event, and maybe where even Phaedimia was particularly injured some way or another, you know what I mean? If there's like some evil event that one of those guys is – the balance of blood is like really specific, and maybe it's almost like Britannia is inviting the Albasti in. Does that make sense? Where it kind of like, crystallizes it?
So there's like – yeah, I think he meant Phaedimia. Yeah.
Phaedimia, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So there's some horrible event. Like there was a massacre of a bunch of Alan captives. Let's say they brought a bunch of Alans that they captured and brought them back to the villa, and he personally massacres them all. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, or
more personal? Like what is Phaedimia's heritage? Where is she from?
She's Armenian as well.
So she's Armenian. Maybe her brother. Or some conquered people. Or something, and she is the prize that he takes.
What if she's an Alan?
Yeah, an Alan, right. Or something like that, or even the whatever the opponent was beforehand, you know, or whatever that he rolled him over, and she's like his prize, you know. I mean, she's his. So you know, go ahead.
The idea is that the Albasti takes her sort of as an agent of retribution for her for something that happened to her people or her brother or...
Yeah, it's got to be particularly bad. It's not just like the conquering of people, though. It's like the way that it happened. Like it's like a trust that is broken or something. Like they all come in to the
peace talks, and then
the
he kills
peace
them
talk, or, yeah, and he slaughters everyone.
Or she comes in with a message, and then she her family is killed, whatever, some sort of, yeah.
Something like that, and it's personal, and even the name, the balance of blood, that's like an event. It's like you got to balance that event with like Vahavunis falling down. I think that makes like one whatever the evil thing is, you know what I mean? I think that draws it home, and it makes Phaedimia a particularly strong, well, not just suspect, but a particularly strong object to be possessed.
Mm-hmm. Right, and maybe the Albasti needs, as you were saying, as you said, Steve, I think, needs some sort of invitation or some level of invitation.
Yeah.
And the fact that Phaedimia dislikes Vahavunis apparently now, and maybe Britannius as well, for whatever trap, maybe he was part of the trap setting, is what sort of allowed, you know, maybe she does some ill-advised, man, I wish I could get, you know, sort of like a you know, genie wish. I wish I could get back at these people. And boom. And,
yeah. And if you wanted some misdirection, then maybe what you have is Britannios visible to the player characters. He's doing all the stuff that looks evil. And Vahavunis seems like, oh, he's almost like a nice guy or something. But he's the one who's ordering all this stuff. You know what I mean? So, like, they're both evil, but like a different kind of evil. Does that make sense? If you want kind of a conflict between those two things. But yeah, I think the one specific event, I think that makes it stronger. But
that also might bring your moral quandary in nicely, because if we have sympathy for her, but she's also the one who is acting against Rome, effectively by acting against Vahavunis, then there's a tough choice, right? Do I?
Yeah.
Sympathy for her.
So versus, well, right. Yeah. So the other way of doing it, if you want to maintain the mystery, would be at some point, because we don't know where the monster comes from. It just sort of appears. But instead of her calling it down, what if somebody in the village called it down? And you sort of at some point are able to track towards the end, like, oh, well, I called it down. It's going to be somebody that, you know, must be able to get close to Vahavunis. It must be
what
somebody
he
trusts.
What about the midwife?
Musa, right? Yeah, she's...
Well, but she's helpful in the beginning with the thing. You could certainly use her, but maybe there's a... maybe somebody whose family was killed by them. She still seems sympathetic to the... And that was actually a problem for me, too, in terms of figuring... Not a problem. A great thing about it was... was like she was still sympathetic to the mother, like, oh, she's been through so right. much. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, she still likes the mother, boy. And she's, I would assume she'd be attuned to, there's a demon in this woman.
Right. Yeah,
but somebody else in the village, maybe even the priest, who, by the way, I love the fact that we're at the last session and we're finally getting around to meeting the local priest. I mean, maybe it's somebody like that, and, you know, it could be anybody in the village who does it.
Could it be the family of the boy who was chained up to the pillory?
Exactly.
It could be that's what I was we were looking for that kind of person, mm-hmm. I think. And I think – so, it's a question of do you – want us to find the person or not.
Right.
Well,
right.
So, yeah. But oh, sorry. Go ahead, Max.
Well, yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say that if you say, hey, it's the curse has been brought down on somebody close to him, it limits the suspects without – because remember, we were at one point like maybe one of the villagers is coming from out of town, and they're mm-hmm. the ones who are leaving these notes. We need to find out everybody – in a 5-mile radius who writes Greek.
Mm-hmm.
Like you could limit down without unnecessarily doing it so to, okay, it's one of the people who you have a picture of in the very beginning.
I guess that's what I was saying though, that if it is the family of that boy, that's a really strong signpost. Whereas if it's just somebody in the village, that's a much less strong signpost.
Yeah. No, Yep.
What I was going to say is you could even make that Musa, the midwife, that could be her family. And she could, she could have maybe unleashed this wanting to get retribution for something that Vahavunis did to her family. But she wanted to it's like she kind of opened the floodgates a little too much. Mm-hmm. And she wants to protect the boy. She doesn't want any fallback going for him. You know, she cares for him and he's innocent and everything, but she wants Vahavunis to feel the wrath, the balance of blood for what he's done to her. And it doesn't have to be the midwife, but I think that could be strong if it's too much, if it's more than what she bargained for kind of thing. That could also be a reason to still give the charm to say, hey, yeah, give this to protect him.
Right. She feels guilty now.
Yeah.
The only thing, it would have to be real delicate of how I handle as a GM, how I handle that, because I wouldn't, you talk to Musa pretty early in the scenario.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to like reveal, oh, it's Fadimia in the first 2 or 3 hours of the scenario.
Right.
Right. But then you could also, it could go both ways. You could reveal that Musa was somehow involved in this, and people could think that she's the one cursing the family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pretty easily gave us tools to save the boy, you know, and it seems like he's still getting worse, at least the way we progressed since we didn't give it to him early on.
Yeah, you didn't force it on him.
Yeah.
You can always put her right up next to someone else who's suspicious, like the priest, the holy man as well. You know, if Musa is somehow in his family or somehow working for him now that she's out of there, you know, it, put her next to somebody who else who's suspicious, and maybe that, you know, deflects. So they don't, the whole thing isn't out of the bag right away.
But then again, we already have a lot of suspicious people in this scenario.
Yeah,
you
know, that's
right. Add more.
I mean, it seems like effectively it's sort of random, right? Basically, the Al-Basti says, here's some bad dude. I'm going to come and cause him some trouble. Oh, look, here's somebody I can hang out in while I'm doing this because she happens to be here. Is that sort of the... sort of what your thinking is on that?
So I'm not quite sure I understand what you're getting at, but basically she is attracted there by Vahuvunis's evil.
Right.
And
Phaedimia as a host is just convenient.
Correct. Mostly, again, because of that folklore tie of
right.
These things are easily able to take control of pregnant women.
So I think I mean, it seems to me there's two random things. One is, you know, Vahuvunis isn't that bad, but, you know, we're just going to – Al-Basti decides to go after him and maybe Prytanius as well. And then the other sort of random thing is Phaedimia. So when the Al-Basti decides that she wants to mess with Vahuvunis, she discovers a pregnant woman. And she's like, oh, cool. I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think – it was probably that randomness that Sean enjoyed so much, meaning that there was no clue trail because there wasn't
obvious
there.
Answer. Yeah.
I mean, there's no. Yeah. I mean, it could have been.
There's no way for you to know that.
I mean, yeah. The Al-Basti could have easily have gone after any other of the 1,000 warlords in the empire. and she just happened to choose this one. And so I guess that's a question of where you want to put that dial. And because one of the things that, you know, I think Call of Cthulhu celebrates is this idea of things we don't understand and can't understand. And so in that sense, the lack
right.
of clue of logical clue pattern. Is,
the term
is fair
uncaring,
game.
Yeah. Uncaring universe has been tossed about a bit. Right.
Right. Right. And
do
so in that
think,
sense, this was a really good example of that, I thought.
Right.
Cool.
It is. It's one
but
of those,
it can be frustrating to players who are expecting to be unraveling a mystery.
But I think that's also what kept you going the whole time, is that you were like, okay, well,
I want to find out.
Tried this. I don't know. I'm not sure. Let's keep going and try and find out for sure.
I think it's
a weird mix of emotions, because like as a person, I want to solve it. But as a player, it was fun to not be able to solve it.
I think I also, as a GM, let you go down a few dead-end alleys too far, whereas I could have, and I ended up doing this in the last session or two, saying, oh, you go and look into that and there's nothing to it.
I mean, I think there's sort of two ways, either to change the story to put something there or... to just say, yeah, nothing there.
Which is, by the way, what I did with the caves with the dragon men in it. So that's not
cool.
I never wrote that. You guys really wanted to go find the dragon men, so I gave you a fight with the dragon men.
And you wanted to save some for later because you knew you needed them at the end. And that was great for us to only have to fight half of them at the end. So that was awesome.
Right.
Yeah, it would have been much nastier with 8 of them.
Is this the right time to ask how the other group handled things then? Since we're talking about blind alleys, what you did and didn't let us, or the ways that we did and did not.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other group was much more circumspect in their investigation and snuck into Prytanios's. They didn't confront him. They didn't really push the whole, you know, we're from Rome. Get out of our way sort of thing. I think they played it a lot safer, and that just happens to be the way that group does things. they're much more like, we don't want to get stomped, so let's be extra careful about everything. Whereas you guys are much more open to just trying something that sounds interesting or fun. They did end up fighting at the end. They did not have the this was another thing with the Star Stone, the ritual that he had to weaken her. That definitely so we ran into two things. One is the scenario was running long, and I didn't want us to go into a whole nother session. So I kind of ended the fight pretty quickly at the end of last session. But it kind of made sense with the ritual. So what the ritual did was it was draining her power in a certain radius. And the other playtest group didn't do that ritual. They didn't get in cahoots with Prytanios. They just treated him as a suspect the whole time, so they never really enlisted his aid. Whereas you guys, through all of the machinations and the conflict, actually ended up forcing Bahavunis to, you know, make the two of you work together.
I liked that you gave us that in the end. I sort of felt like you as a keeper were giving us Prytanios doing the ritual. And I thought that was a good keeper move.
Okay.
It gave us a win in a, even though we weren't, but we're still suspicious of him.
Is he actually going to turn on us at the last minute?
Well, and the mechanic of spending POW before making a bunch of important POW rolls, that's also a nice.
So one of the things that I was frustrated at, and maybe this is just tuning and balancing, but and you guys brought it up, like there wasn't a whole lot of sanity loss. And because of that, you were able to make your sanity rolls. And so you never, you know, I don't think anyone ever went temporarily insane.
But then again, I think that's a good thing because of all the investigation that had to happen. It wasn't like a really short scenario where, okay, there's one or two things to investigate and then you get to the main climax.
Yeah, but like maybe after one of the dream sequences, if that had the potential to lose more, that it could have set one of the characters off or whoever fails.
We don't have to start so high either. I mean, I think a bunch of us were up at 80 or, I mean.
Yeah, I like 90 or 70s, something.
70s, 80s, 90. Yeah, I mean, there was some high starting sand.
Okay. So that's easy to make those numbers lower.
What would have happened if we had run, I'm sorry, if we had run Prytanios through at that one moment? Would that have unleashed all kinds of crazy stuff right in the middle?
It would have actually.
Well, would have been a harder fight with Al-Basti.
It would have been a much harder fight.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't have had the stone, and he was kind of occupying two of the dragon men for the first couple of rounds.
Right.
So what happens when he dies, regardless of when he dies, either if it's the cataphracts kill him because you turn Bahavunis against him, or you attack him, or the Al-Basti kills him at the end, is he's made this pact with Sakuth, which is his evil god. Sakuth shows up to get his due and coalesces as this sort of shadowy figure. And of course, that causes an additional sanity check to anyone that sees that. And then basically drains all of Prytanios' blood up into itself and then dissipates. So it doesn't attack anyone, but it's there. If you attack it, it does a bunch of, I think, strength drain on you.
Oh my God, we should have totally killed him. That would have been an awesome scene.
Yeah. So, and that did not happen in the playtest either. They never attacked him or turned anyone against him. So,
but I think it was going to happen if Scriptor hadn't, Jim hadn't made the really good roll in whatever the handwriting.
Well, and I had that 100 botch on my insight.
Oh yeah, so you really trusted him, and and Jim, you figured out that hey, this is not his handwriting.
Yep. Good role playing instead of metagaming there on that one, because that actually had repercussions for several sessions thereafter, I think.
Oh yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
My player frustration, I remember noticing, I think about an hour and a half, or it was as we were wrapping up the night before, not the session before, but like our characters were about to go to bed. It was at that point that as a player, I felt there are no more alleys to go down. Yep. We have figured everything out that we can figure out. I want to skip straight to the
final scene.
Because I know, as a player, I know that I'll find out what's happening at that. You know, that was an obvious finale, was the moon thing, ceremony. And so I was ready to and you did a nice job of pushing us to that. I mean, that's when you sort of started, I think, cutting off.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think that was good. And it may be that
not soon enough.
Well, that was on us, because I think we kept, you know, we kept being like, oh, wait, one more thing. Oh, wait, one more thing. You know, like we weren't quite willing as a group to give up and just say, let's go find out what happens. So I don't put that on you, and I don't know if there's any way to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, that night also felt very awkward to me, and I felt like, okay, they have decided that the only way to finish the scenario is to let time pass and go to the next day. And that was frustrating to me as a keeper, that I could tell you guys had no more
ideas.
Yeah. I guess I could make an idea roll, but I hate, I don't know.
Well, and I think
that's not
that
what you're
point,
suggesting.
There wasn't enough information for us to think even an idea roll wouldn't really tell us the whole story. So,
well, and there's nothing to choose to do at that point, right?
Like, right.
Except
right.
Let time
so here, here's something you could have happen, I suppose, now that we know what's going on. There could be a Fademia could have some sort of an episode.
If
on
you
the
get
night
that
before
far
the full moon,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that would be, well, even yeah, and even if it doesn't clue us in, it's still it's something for the players and the characters to react to, which is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Right. it's a way to fill that evening.
And so maybe you think, oh, now she's getting attacked with a moon sickness or something like that, like a Teridates.
Right. How are we going to protect
her?
Yeah.
It could be a seizure. I like the
maybe
idea.
Maybe she
that
like maybe
more than
pushes through, and is like, you know, where am I? What am I doing here? What's going on?
Yeah,
you know, kind
right.
of doesn't yeah. not remembering where she's at.
Mm-hmm. And if you add some of those things we talked about before, with not remembering all the dolls or not remembering a Teridates reminding her, no, remember you did this or whatever, then we actually, again, it's actually seeing it happen. Yeah, yeah, I like that. Might be something.
Yeah, you know, though, I would condense the time frame. The legate is coming the day after the ceremony or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yep.
Maybe condense the number of days and then mm-hmm. just let it go. I mean, I think it's okay that, you know, the sign of a really good mystery is we could have solved it, but we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you weren't part of the Sunday game a couple days ago when we blew up most of Salem. Like, there was a way of not doing that we didn't figure out, and I think that's great.
It's okay, yeah.
Because there was a way we could have done it if we had been a little bit more this, a little more that. We didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Things blew up. We lost sanity at the end of that chapter rather than gaining
right.
any. And I think your scenario is the same thing. As long as I, as a player, I know you say, well, good role-playing, not meta, but like a convention game, I know at hour three and a half, things are going down regardless of where I am in the game. And that's, I think as long as you keep that schedule, I don't, you know, I guess if you wanted to introduce things to engage the players a little bit more, maybe you bring in some of the political stuff.
Well, and to be clear, this is not a convention scenario. It's too long, obviously.
It's too long for that. But
yeah.
But I think as a player, if I know we have 3 days in game time to solve this.
Mm-hmm.
And the clock is ticking. The
clock is ticking, yeah.
Maybe we're not wandering up the mountainside to go looking for dragon men.
Maybe what I do then is, in that briefing with the legate at the beginning, he's like, they have this special ceremony on day X, on the Ides of March, and I need you to be there. I'm going to show up the next day, and come up with some reasoning for that. But basically,
is there any reason he can't want to come to the ceremony? Because that would put the pressure on.
The legate?
Yeah.
I guess he could, but I think it would accelerate things a little bit too much. I want the opportunity for you to be there to screw things up. Oh, so he's intending to be there on the Ides, and you all think he's going to be there, but then he doesn't mm-hmm. show up in time.
Yeah, because, one of the things that gave me a breathing room, which I'm not sure I should have had, was, I know the full moon ceremony is when shit's going to hit the fan, but that's okay. Whereas if I think that the ceremony is where shit's going to hit the fan and the legate's going to be there, I need to clear it up before the ceremony. I can't wait and just say, whatever happens at the ceremony will be fine. Although then I guess there's danger that go ahead.
Yeah, to me then the danger is that the players are like, wait, I need to do something the night before. Wait, it's still the night before. We need to do this other thing. And they wouldn't
And I wasn't, to Sean's point, I wasn't necessarily suggesting that we should get a clue that night, just simply that there could be stuff happening that night. If you stuff to keep us occupied and maybe whatever, I don't know, help us pass the time.
And I guess one of the things is in the timeline, because it really is a sandbox and there's a number of different things that can happen whenever you guys bump into them. But then there's a schedule of certain events that will happen. So in the timeline, as I originally wrote it, Andragoras is supposed to attack that night before. And I think I had that, maybe it was the night before, but it was just so, like, we were taking so long, it felt like it was a whole day prior. So that's kind of the triggering event on that day three or whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about when he attacked us as we were trying to put the necklace on the boy, right?
So as it was written, he attacks during dinner, if that's convenient. I think you guys had something else going on, and so that's what interrupted that. But he attacks during dinner. He tries to attack Vavunis. And actually, this was something that I spun up on the spur of the moment. The Numantina spell, which is the thing with the scarf around it that makes Andragoras go crazy, in the way I originally wrote it, it was just him. But it made a lot more sense to me, kind of in the spur of the moment, that it was all the cataphracts.
Mm-hmm.
So I was also afraid that if all the rest of the cataphracts were still there, the entire rest of the scenario was going to be just way too easy for you. So I took them all out of action, basically. But I think I'm going to write that into the actual write-up.
Yeah, I guess it's a question of, is it more interesting for them to be crazy or just sick? I mean, either way, they're out of they're out of commission. So this is something
want
that
them all to attack.
This is something that the Albasti did to Andragoras to continue to mess things up for Vahavunis and Britannius.
Yep. Yeah, it's like, it's his nephew, and so I'm going to make him go insane, and then I'm going to make him attack, and then the most likely outcome is the other cataphracts kill him or the players kill him. And that's just increasing the suffering of Vahavunis, basically.
Right.
So one last question I have. And then if you have any other feedback or questions, the curse tablets, I liked the concept, but they do feel out of place and they did send you off on a wild goose chase a bit. So do you have any other ideas of ways? Because she plants them there as a frame, a setup for Prytanios. So I need something that makes Prytanios look like he's definitely the bad guy that she has planted.
Right. You know, it could be as simple as something from the... It could be anything in that temple that is stolen from, you know, the doll or a doll or, I mean, it could be something much more innocent as long as it's in that temple.
A symbol of the Vahavunai. Something
stolen. Yeah. Or even just something quote unquote dropped, you know, if I don't know, it could be the jewelry, you know, maybe it's her jewelry or I don't know, something.
So you could have us. You remember when the creature attacked the horses? We went looking around. Maybe we find something that we recognize as a pendant that the Greek was wearing earlier.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, what was he doing out here in the woods? He's like, I wasn't there. And we're like, no, but we hate you, so you were there.
The reason I like the Greek tablets or the curse tablets as they are written in Greek is because the only reason Prytanios didn't get killed is because of some very specific extreme roles. I mean, to me, the best case scenario for that, I don't think it's going to happen very often the way it happened with us just because of the nature of the roles. But I think the best case scenario is the players kill Prytanios, the whole thing with Sakuth happens, and then afterwards they figure out, hey, wait a minute, this isn't even
he was the bad
right.
guy.
Well, yeah, and, this wasn't and even if, a guy.
If that happens, right, like let's say you killed him when you were about to, then the next night you still have the dreams, Narsa, the boy slave, dies, then Artaridates goes crazy. So stuff keeps happening even after you killed Prytania. So at that point, it's obvious that he wasn't the cause of this, or at least he's not controlling it actively.
So maybe the handwriting is an out because there's still a chance. Like you said, if it's an object, then there's nothing for us to check it against.
That's true.
Maybe that's
I mean,
the way
it did work
to go.
Well. Maybe what it means is having some more solid. I think we probably gave you, you know, 15 different directions that we tried to go in to solve that mystery because our first thought was, okay, Prytanios, we almost killed him. And then once that was shut down, well, then we sort of, said, well, here's 12 other directions we might go. Maybe that's a little sidebar in your scenario to help the keeper not have to improv so much in response to a group pushing out in all those directions.
So what would your advice to the keeper be in that case?
Here's a list of people that speak Greek. It was really weird that we couldn't find that this is this Armenian thing that's written in Greek that like I think just some sort of something that just makes it comfortable. There is no way these things could have come from here. They've obviously been teleported in, or I don't know where they came from, but
that was sort of hand waved, right? Even when I was thinking about it, it's like somehow she gets her hands on this, and I thought
maybe
initially
maybe you need a clue trail there, or maybe if the players are lucky enough to not kill Prytanios, then maybe there should be a clue trail of how
find
Phaedimia,
some tablets in her room or.
I guess the question of figuring out did the Albasti do it in the Albasti form or in Phaedimia's form, or was the Albasti controlling some other creature, some other person, and that other person did it?
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say is that there's a Swiss Army knife to the Albasti's skill set because she's able to kill people in the house and isn't caught, tears up a horse. Causes the guards to go crazy, his carving, you know, curve tools. There's just a lot going on there, and I think you should sort of focus in on what is it the Albasti does that's really good they're really good at and sort of figure out how to build things that happen around that.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer to your question is some of the dust from doing the carving could be inside the house itself.
Mm-hmm. The lead dust.
The lead stuff is in the house. And now we're like, okay, well, now we're to a smaller – because that's ultimately what I think you're hopefully looking for is over time the list of suspects becomes smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're all
without necessarily. I don't think you want to point to one person until the ceremony is going on. All of a sudden, the Albassi rips herself out, mm-hmm. which I think is great.
But I think your point is really good, and it does kind of bother me about. Well, the Albassi can mind control, and she sucks brains out, and she can ride horses, and she can turn the stone creatures back to life, and. She's like this omnipotent thing just to set up the mystery, which doesn't feel very satisfying.
I kind of had, towards the end, I kind of wasn't really sure who the main bad guy was. I felt like there was the Albasti. Mm-hmm. I felt like there's the woman in red in our dreams, which, you know, turned out to be mm-hmm. kind of the same thing. And I also felt like there were the dragon men. I was like, okay, well, who's pulling the strings from all this? And was the Albasti just summoned from somebody? So there's somebody else that's pulling it. And I think that's,
So you're saying you want it more cleanly wrapped up? Because I kind of feel like what Sean was saying, where there are these different bad things going on and there is no single answer, right? But maybe that's not satisfying to play through.
I guess what I'm saying is I think with regards to kind of cleaner hierarchically, does that make sense? Like he said, Sean mentioned the Swiss Army knife of different like powers. Like if you kind of minimize the Albasti's kind of MO, like if she's the one pulling the strings, somehow you tie the woman in red to the Albasti so we know that she's like the same one and not a different one.
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? So that there's like a sense of who the bad guy is, maybe?
So maybe the dreams need to be more targeted and actually communicative rather than just threatening. You have to see some vision of Nyarlathotep or of the woman in red.
What if the dreams tried to get us to do things that would further her goal? So she's not mind controlling us in the same way that she's controlling some of the others, but if we get this vision and all of a sudden now through this vision we now think that Vahavunis is guilty of something or Pretanius is guilty of something or whatever,
mm-hmm.
we are both going to act on it and we're going to realize that other people may be acting under sort of false impressions, if that makes sense.
Yep, it does. And I think, again, to go to the Swiss Army knife thing, I think if maybe her power was this whole mind control thing and that's how she did everything, so mm-hmm. she's not necessarily
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
poking the brains out and cutting the liver out, but and she's not making the curse tablets, but she's getting somebody else to do those things,
which
that would give us lots of clues, which would be fun.
Yeah, and if you think of her as an avatar of Nyarlathotep causing chaos and things like that too, you know, that's kind of pulling the strings, puppet mastery type thing. I think that ties
in. And I like the idea of there being lots of clues that still don't help us any because it's still chaos, it's still confusion. And
Yeah.
Because then we're going to go like, oh, this person made the tablets and this person works for so-and-so and they're with the Allens. That's but then this other person, oh shit, there's still like seven things going on here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And cool. Then eventually, it circles closer and closer into the – especially if some of us are also part of the problem.
Right. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
No. I was going to kind of summarize and wrap up, but.
So I was going to say that one thing I really enjoyed as a player was the ability to take the supernatural in stride because we were in the Roman era and the gods are among us and weird shit happens. That was also sort of felt proper with the not a lot of sanity loss for some of these things, because I think that was a fun. Of course, there's portents, and of course, like, yeah, obviously the full moon's a thing. Like, why wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
So I think that's something that you can probably push if you know, if there's little tweaks here and there as you're thinking about that. That was a fun part of the world.
And not just us, but everybody feels that way, right? It's like not just a few kind of woke characters walking around. It's the whole world that's that way, right?
Well, that's right. That's definitely inherent to the whole Invictus setting. And, Chad Bowser and even now Oscar, they both really focus on how, you know, there are augurs. There's a character class that's an augur, and many people have their lares, which are the house gods, and they believe in this stuff, and they believe in some of the myths.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the whole thing with sanity is that sanity is supposed to be this exposure to something that's incomprehensible, whereas the normal myths of Roman and Greek mythology are much more like personified. These are gods personified, as opposed to Cthulhu, who's just not comprehensible at all. So I think I think you can still do both.
Oh, but, absolutely. No, I was just thinking, if I personally ran into any of this stuff, I'd flip my lid.
Yeah.
Right? Like, for me, even a personified god as a, like, you know, as a real something that intervenes in my life, like, whoa. But as a Roman at that era, sure, yeah, that's the way it should be. Yeah. So I think that's a neat thing to have the different degrees of
disbelief.
Well, no, I was gonna say the different degrees of superpowers. Whatever the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
But yeah. This is normal magic, whereas that's really weird magic.
So that seems like a good segue, talking about the Roman era and what it's like to play characters and role-play characters, segueing into our other discussion about, and this is where I want to hear from you guys, what was it like to play slaves, Jim, to play somebody who's taking the orders of someone else?
Oh, I have to answer that?
You don't have to.
Only if the sublegate demands it.
Yeah, well,
exactly. Yes, you do.
If the sublegate insists that I answer. No, it's fine. I mean, it's like with most things, it's all about the group dynamic, right? With this particular group, I'm not that concerned about it, because I know that, you know, whoever is the in charge character, you know, in this case, right, Edwin, there's going to be opportunities for autonomy. I mean, even before Edwin just frees all his slaves, right, which felt out of character, but you know, it was a nice touch. I could certainly see with a group that was less experienced, or players that you didn't know, or, I mean, you know, no one who does this, you know, regularly. I mean, there are no jerks out there, right? Of course, that's never a problem. That could get a little touchy, you know, if you're just kind of sitting there quietly off the side and, excuse me, sublegate, I have a suggestion, you know, just, you know, trying to throw that in every once in a while and just get completely ignored. That could certainly happen, but, you know, like I say, I think it's all about the group dynamics and the, knowing what to expect from your fellow players.
Know your players.
Yeah. You know,
maybe it's worth a paragraph in the Keepers section about, you know, hey, if you're playing this in a gaming store where you don't know the people who are going to play, maybe not use the slave character, or
something like that.
Or maybe use the slave character, but explain to them the importance of, you know, playing in the time that the scenario is set in, but also don't forget that there's, you know, other people involved in the scenario that are playing.
Yeah, that, don't use the sub-legged character.
Exactly. Well, yeah, that's...
I think it's a fun experience to play as with the different, you know, yeah, like castes, the different levels of society. I think that's fun, you know, getting into character like that. But like Jim said, yeah, if you just put a bunch of randoms together.
Yeah, and I think Edwin's suggestion is the better way to go. I think, you know, if you find that you're in a situation where that is even going to be potentially a concern, right? It's to work down, not to work up, right? I think the sublegate is the first one who should become an NPC.
Interesting, right?
Because it, you know, everyone else in that party, even though there's only really the one slave, you know, he's still an important enough a slave that, you know, he really only works for the sublegate. You know, it's much closer to a peer relationship with everyone else. It's really only that one character of the sublegate who is, you know, very clearly head and shoulders above everyone else.
Mm-hmm. And they all report to him, and they are all basically under his orders.
Yeah, so that's really the easiest one to take out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
so what I did, I have a Cthulhu Invictus scenario I put together, and it has a slave character in it, and that slave reports to an NPC who never appears. It's the guy who owns the business. Everybody knows that, you know, the slave really only reports to him, so it creates a sort of level playing field. Yes, he's a slave, but nobody in this group would want to take the chance of ordering him around.
Do you think in this scenario, would it work to not have that sort of main representative? Because I wouldn't want, like, from the GM standpoint, I would not want to run the sublegate for the entire thing.
Well, no, I think
I would get rid of
that. The legate is sent to the legate sends his slave along to keep notes for him, and everybody knows that he's keeping notes and will report to the legate.
But would the rest of the scenario work if it was just like take Edwin's character out of there, and so you've got a slave, you've got a freed slave who's a translator, you've got a couple of guards, you've got a priest. Like, does the priest then just become the leader?
I think it's fine to have the sublegate as long as the slave reports to the legate.
I see what you're getting
at.
That actually creates an even more interesting dynamic, because then, mm-hmm. then everyone, the legate included, is going to be afraid of the slave because what's he going to say
like
to
those Soviet subs where there was a captain, but there was also a political officer, and the political officer people were more, you know, as scared of as the captain.
Yep.
Well, and you sort of brought in that role a little bit, Sean, with the flamen of like, yeah, you might be under the orders, but on the other hand, you represent the church. Right. So there's
that was just me dicking around though. I mean,
no, but I think it was good. I mean, it added an interesting dynamic that if you just said, oh, yes, sublegate, and you went along with his, like, it wouldn't have been, I think, quite as interesting. And I, you know, I fear the same thing for Randall and Max's characters, where they're basically just soldiers and they're just standing around waiting for the orders.
Well, let me ask this. If you do wind up with just the legate slave there, and we take the sublegate out, the person of actual authority, then what do you wind up with? And do you have one person nominally in charge,
that's him and the slave? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, do you have, you still have,
I like
dual heads?
Or I like their idea better where the slave doesn't report to the sublegate. The sublegate's still there. But in a sense, the slave is then, he's got some power over the sublegate because he's like, I'm going to report back to your boss if you don't do this right.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the sublegate really is important because you do have to have somebody who can talk to Vahavunis on a peer level.
Right.
Right. Yeah. You don't really bring the gravitas of Rome, right?
And that would make it was so I kind of felt playing the sublegate a little bit like I feel when I'm keeping, that I really, really had to listen hard to everybody else, because what I was trying to do was, as soon as I heard some character or player sort of suggest something, figure out a way to order them to do that. Mm. And that was kind of tiring. And so taking that off from me as a player, I would not have complained about.
Right. Is there a way to create some fighting roles, or, you know, more of that type of character without making them just soldiers who are subordinate to?
Sure. Maybe there's the legate's son.
Mm-hmm.
Or the legate's son, or the legate's general, you know, somebody who's a, like, I was there as a political officer, but there could have been a military officer there with sort of a.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Similar. So now you could have two people who might actually be vying for political points back home against each other.
And would have different solutions to the same problems, or different. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're bringing in some of this other political stuff with the gallons or the whatever other sort of. Go ahead, Max.
And then you could have, you know, slave or freedman characters in the service of both of these different powerful characters. That would be
fun. Can I just go back, though? I think, Matt, it would be worthwhile to have a character who has the skills of Jim's character but isn't a slave to anybody. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is I am a white dude who primarily plays at conventions with white dudes and not white women, but I don't know what happens on the day that somebody sits down, they're a little late, and they're the sort of person that doesn't actually want to experience being a slave.
Right. Well, and there are actually... So I think you guys picked all the characters. Well, yes. No, I see exactly what you're getting at. My intention is that there are more pre-gens than there are players.
Great.
So that they can pick.
Yep.
The translator and the scribe are close to the same thing. I mean, they don't exactly mirror each other, but I think that's good too. But you could get by with one or the other of them if you were trying to avoid, yeah. I think. Is that what you were trying to do when you made those two?
I just wanted to make sure that there was at least one character that had some, like, language skills.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I could easily just get rid of the fact that he's a slave and he could just be a servant of the Empire.
Well, and I did like, kind of as a scenario, that you had almost one of every type of class of characters for people to play. So that was, I thought that was pretty interesting. But I definitely can see how amending this for a con scenario, taking out the slave and making it the sublegate and a group of trusted people he's worked with before.
Yeah.
Can I ask you?
Peers could work as well.
Can I throw out to the group, as a thought from a guy who, you know, doesn't have a lot of experience running stuff, what do you think would happen if you kept the sublegate as an NPC, but what he wound up doing was just like spending all of his time laying on a couch eating grapes with Vaha Lunas and just saying, yeah, you guys go take care of this stuff, you know what I mean, as an NPC, so that you have someone who's nominally in charge.
Longer scenario that might work. But if you're trying to get this to a little bit over a con scenario or shorter than that, it could be frustrating running extra moving parts.
Yeah. So my input, like, there are already a lot of scenes in there that I, as a keeper who's not fantastic role player, was really uncomfortable with, where it's like, there's Androgoras, Phaedimia, Prytanios, and Vaha Lunas, and I've got to roleplay all of them, and then you'd be asking me to also roleplay, you know, this fifth or sixth character who's got a much closer relationship to the players. I kind of want them to feel like they're in this strangers in a strange land, and they've got to figure it out themselves. They can't go to him for, you know, hey, what do we do now?
Right, right. That's what I meant. If he were like an aloof guy, is like, yeah, this is your job. You know, I'm kind of not necessarily a competent sublegate. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that solves the problem, is what I was saying, because we're talking about having people in charge and running things or whatever. If your guy who's running things is kind of absentee and kind of.
Well, actually, let's ask Edwin, because the Cthulhu Invictus game, because we were short players, the people that were nominally in charge of what was going on did exactly that. They kind of sat around drinking and reading books.
Huh. The actual PCs.
They were PCs, but people didn't show up.
Oh, so that's exactly what happened.
I see.
Yes, and I'm wondering from Edwin what your experience was as the, oh, go fix this type thing.
It worked. It worked well, but it felt a little strange to have to, well, first of all, we played the leaders a few times. Like, we sort of took them on temporarily when it was important.
Yep.
But it also felt a little bit like we were pushing above our station. And it worked out because, you know, you let it work out, but it took a little bit, out of the role, I guess. Like, well, I'm just going to have to pretend that I don't have a boss because I don't have a boss.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks.
One thing I was thinking about on Sean's point, and also, and this might be some really interesting different ways in at this mystery, is if the contingent has some women in it. And I don't know who
actually,
they would be.
Almost all of the characters could be either way. So when I ran it for my local group, I actually had more female players than males because my wife and three of my female friends like Call of Cthulhu. So it's dominated. The priestess, so Sean's character was a priestess. Yep. The scriptor was a female. And I can't remember if my wife played one of the – this is obviously completely historically inaccurate, but didn't matter. I think she played one of the soldiers as a Briton, a female Briton.
I think nice. That would be worth pushing on the – when you prepare the pre-gens is just leave them open and prepare a little note on that, because I think that would interestingly change the role play potentials.
Mm-hmm. Well, all you gotta do is just split the picture and do a high
the different names
backslash with a name
names. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No,
just
make them dual. That works perfect.
Yep.
Yeah, it would have been a different, especially knowing what we know now. It would have been a potentially very different, because somebody might have. You know, hung out with Faedimia until the wee hours, and then W would have passed out, and who knows what would have gone down? But it could have been pretty cool.
yeah. None of us would have been allowed in her rooms for sure. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate the feedback. I have like 3 pages of scrawled notes. And, appreciate your patience.
No. Well, I want to say again. I think it was an excellent scenario.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, out of the 16 hours, there was, as I said, there was maybe about 20 minutes when I was like, "Oh, come on." So I mean, that's a pretty damn good ratio in my mind.
Cool.
And I think in that final combat was tense. I mean, obviously, we didn't have time to finish it with dice rolls, but I think the way that's how I would have probably cleaned it up too. Just like, okay, we're done. But I think that there was enough interesting stuff going on there with her different magics, plus the Pritanius's stuff, plus the mind control NPCs, plus the dragon men. I mean, it was not just sort of a stand and hack at each other until you fall down.
Right.
So that was good.
Yeah, it's kind of – so one of the things I found running – I ran all of Arius Lurko, which I know you guys played, and then I've run a number of other scenarios. And armor, the way that they do armor in Cthulhu Invictus really makes the combats drag on.
Yeah.
I think Oscar's decreased it a little bit by adding the dice roll, but now it's another thing you have to do during the combat.
But, I mean – if you're in combat, you have those dice out. It goes pretty quickly. It's actually a lot quicker having used it recently.
Yeah. I just know when I ran Arius Lurko, I had a couple guys who were in full Lurica segmentata all the time. And so they were always absorbing like 6 or 7 or 8 points of damage every time something hit them. So I had to throw really tough things at them, which then crushed their non-armored friends.
Well, or psionics. That works pretty well.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Matt. That was really good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
And we'll see y'all next week.
Sounds good. Cool.
All right, bye.
Take care, guys.
Later.
Bye, everybody.